This is Age of Treason Radio.
First thing I remember was asking Papa why. Oh, there were many things I didn't know.
On the White Network.
By the hand, saying someday you'll understand. Well, I'm here to tell you now that you never mother's gone. You better learn your past, you better learn your young, for someday it never comes.
With your host, Tan Stoffel. The title of this installment is Jews versus Whites, Part 3. We're talking about the contrast between Jews and Whites, the glaring differences in behavior, and the standards to which each group is held. It's a natural tendency, I think, of Whites to, and at least in my own mind, I started by taking the first step, which was to consider groups equivalently. But it's perfectly natural to think of your own group as superior, as the superior group. And that's how Whites should see it. But I make this point only to make it clear that there really isn't an equivalence between Jews and Whites, and because Jews wouldn't have it that way. Jews see their own group as superior to Whites, and I've provided several examples of that in previous parts, and I'm going to continue on this same theme and hopefully wrap it up this time. I briefly mentioned last time, and I want to go into a little more detail this time about the different standards when it comes to endogamy versus exogamy, the idea of breeding within your own group, which Jews openly advocate for themselves. And we saw that in the recent Pew poll, that in the poll it was revealed that Jews think that, and that it's a good thing. And in the discussion, the analysis of the poll results, and in Jews discussing it, that they thought it was a big travesty that Jews are marrying out. And it really reflects this difference in attitudes, a 180-degree difference between Whites and Jews, that mostly in how we're regarded. That this is considered totally natural and normal and goes uncriticized of Jews, at least in their media, which they dominate, whereas Whites are criticized for anything that even remotely sounds like encouraging Whites to marry and breed only with Whites, or even preferentially with Whites. And one example of this that was in the news recently, it was back in April, there were actually two stories in the news about Jewish women, and I titled a blog post on it, Two Lessons in Privilege. The first story had to do with a woman named Susan Patton, who, by her last name, you might assume she's not Jewish. And in fact, was the start of the controversy, was that a lot of people jumped to the conclusion that she wasn't Jewish based on that name. She had written in I think it was Princeton Magazine, she's an alumna of Princeton, and wrote an article for them encouraging girls that were going to school there to get married, to find a spouse and get married while they're there in school. And the big controversy about her comments was that, jumping to the conclusion that she was some kind of WASP and that this was a racist thing to do, to encourage women to find a husband in school. She actually said, "You will never again have this concentration of men who are worthy of you. Find a husband on campus before you graduate." But soon after the controversy erupted, she made it clear that she wasn't a WASP, that she was Jewish, and she played the Jewish mother card. She actually said, "You know, I thought I was just being a good Jewish mother." And the minute she said that, the controversy cleared up immediately. Immediately, all of the people that were criticizing her stopped criticizing her. Why? Because Jews are treated to a totally different standard than whites when it comes to this sort of thing. The Jewish mother phrase immediately invoked this understanding that Jewish mothers have a stereotype of encouraging their children to find a nice Jewish doctor to marry, to find a nice Jew to get married to. And it's not just Jewish mothers, of course, it's Jewish fathers too. What caused the confusion is she married out. I presume that her first husband that she ultimately got divorced from, the one she got her surname Patton from, was not a Jew. The other story, the other woman, Jewish woman who was in the news was Susie Lee Weiss, who was applying to college and just so happened to come out about the same time, this story. Her controversy was that she complained that she wasn't getting into the elite colleges that she wanted to get into, and she blamed it on her lack of diversity. She said she had about as much diversity as a saltine cracker. And somehow she got her opinion published in the Wall Street Journal, which is strange, you know, for somebody who's so unprivileged, until you look into her background. And her background is that it must be her father who's Jewish, but she's also, I'm guessing, half Jewish. And immediately a bunch of when the controversy erupted that she was just a spoiled, whining white girl, Tablet Magazine came to her defense, referred to her as family, because it turns out her sister works for Tablet Magazine and was formerly an editor for the Wall Street Journal, which is how she got her op-ed published there to begin with. And there were also two articles defending her in Commentary Magazine. So all of these kind of subtle signals that that the Jews recognized her as at least a half member of their tribe and came to her defense. There was another article that was most interesting published in National Review Online titled "To All Colleges That Rejected Susie Weiss," which is German for white, by the way, a common Jewish name when they appropriated that from the Germans. The National Review Online article talks about this confusion between whites and Jews. It actually plays on it. And it notes this out-and-out racial and ethnic discrimination in college admissions, which is fully acceptable in the interest of, quote, diversity, unquote. They literally in the article put quotes around the word diversity, mocking it, as I do when I put quotes around words. Discriminating against culturally non-diverse Caucasians, such as Susie Weiss, is, in their eyes, the right thing to do. Well, what makes it that way? Who runs these elite colleges? Who runs the admissions? What, and even more important than who runs it exactly, what program are they running in their mind? What basis are they going by to discriminate against Caucasians, to make the word diversity mean basically less white? And aren't Jews an exception to that? And, you know, the moral of the story with Susie Lee Weiss is that ultimately she was given all sorts of job offers. Not only did these Jewish magazines come to her defense, as they also did in the case of Susan Patton, lots of positive media exposure after the controversy, after it became clear to certain people that she was Jewish. But this Susie Lee Weiss got job offers afterwards, so she's set. So much for her complaints. It was whining when she was white and to the extent she could be portrayed as white. But for the people who knew that she was actually Jewish, it wasn't, she was no longer a whiner. She was somebody worthy of giving employment to. The National Review Online article goes on to point out that this discrimination in the Ivy League and other top-notch schools, there were similar practices in the 1920s to ensure their schools did not have, quote, too many Jewish students. Today, they just want to make sure they don't have too many Caucasians or Asians on campus. All they have done is change the groups targeted for discrimination. Well, who is they? Who is doing this discrimination? And they is Jews. Jews run the elite colleges, the elite universities in the United States today. The National Review Online article, of course, doesn't say that. They act as if Jews are white and they're subject to this discrimination too. Well, they are. If they don't raise their voice in some way, if they don't wink and nod in the right way, or if they don't just outright say, hey, I'm not white, I'm a Jew, then they will be discriminated against just like whites are. But they have that out. They can always claim their Jewishness overtly or covertly and escape that discrimination. And in fact, Jews are vastly overrepresented at United States universities. One of the people who's popularized that is Ron Unz. Ron Unz is a Jew who I wrote a blog post about last week titled Ron Unz is Anti-White. To give some background to Ron Unz in anticipation of this, discussing him in this podcast, you can read that blog post for more information. But basically, he helped popularize this idea, which was becoming well known anyway, that Jews are tremendously overrepresented at universities and Asians are not so overrepresented. They're overrepresented for their population, but not once you control for academic achievement, IQ, and so forth. Jews are overrepresented no matter how you measure it. And whites are underrepresented no matter how you measure it, either in raw numbers or in academic achievement. And he mentioned that in his long article. He titled it The Myth of American Meritocracy and published it in his magazine, The American Conservative, back in November, about this time last year. That article itself is worthy of a podcast, that and discussing the whole issue of education. But for now, I just want to hit the highlights here. He starts off by basing, as I said, I think he's anticipating or trying to get out in front of something that's becoming well-known anyway. And apparently a lot of his work is based on a book titled The Chosen by Berkeley sociologist Jerome Karabel, who I'm assuming is a Jew, which is he describes as an exhaustive and award-winning 2005 narrative history of the last century of admissions policy at Harvard, Yale, and Princeton. This is the Jewish specialty, of course, is history and the narrative, shaping the narrative in their way. In fact, the National Review Online article mentioned this history of admissions in U.S. colleges, and it comes up all the time. Jews will always mention it. You can find it on a weekly basis in if you read op-eds of major newspapers, because it's the one thing, one fairly concrete thing that Jews can point to as evidence of discrimination in the United States. The what it really was of course, the white Anglo-Saxon Protestants who created the country and ran it and had created these institutions were trying to defend themselves and defend their position, at least to a certain extent. And ultimately, they failed. And the evidence of that failure is that today, they are actually a minority in the very institutions that they themselves created, and they're becoming a vanishing breed. And Unz notes this and a few other interesting things that have changed since those days. But, of course, the Jews are harping always on the 1920s and how they were discriminated against in the 1920s. And the reason for that, of course, is by talking about that, they steal the air from any contemporary complaint about their discrimination against non-Jews. And Unce's article calls attention mainly to the discrimination against Asians. In fact, he calls them the New Jews. He cites somebody else calling them that, but uses this phrase, the New Jews. And I've seen this phrase before. This is a phrase that sometimes is applied to Muslims, especially in Europe. And what does it mean? I mean, this is relevant to our discussion here, the contrast between whites and Jews. Well, this, the New Jews, is a very concise way of referring to the Jewish narrative, of course, which portrays Jews as the victims and whites, Europeans, as their eternal oppressors. And by calling another group the New Jews, they're saying, in a nutshell, that the Jews now, of course, are no longer discriminated against, and it's hard to find any example where they're even criticized substantially. And this other group, though, is being made honorary Jews by the Jews. They're, and it's really only Jews who use this phrase, the New Jews, or somebody who has Jewish approval, because if the Jews didn't approve, of course, they'd scream bloody murder and have that person's head on a platter for using such a phrase. It's meant in a positive way to the Jews as the victims of whites, and they're bestowing this sanctification of themselves, a small part of it, onto this other group, either the Muslims in Europe or, in this case, the Asians in the United States. But, of course, it finesses this point that who is discriminating against the Asians in today's universities? It's the implication is that it's still those damn WASPs discriminating. They were doing it in the 20s to the Jews, and the New Jews today are the Asians. But the reality is, of course, the Jews are the ones who have the power today to do it. So it's the Jews themselves who are doing it. Nice try, though, by using this phrase, the New Jews. But that's how subtle Jewish power is and Jewish influence is the language side of it is subtle. I've made the point about the simple fact of capitalizing certain words and not capitalizing others. Jews pay attention to that level of detail when it comes to language. Unce notes that, and he's not the first one to notice it, that the irony that today the WASPs are number actually less than the Jews in universities, although he also calls attention to the fact that they're usually not separated out. When racial counts are made, it's a coarse racial count of Asians or Caucasians and Africans, and Jews are not separated from whites. Well, Unce distinguishes Jews from whites by calling whites non-Jewish whites. And this is another bugaboo of language that I take note of, that this came up in Carolyn Yeager's discussion of Kristallnacht last Saturday, and she noticed how at a certain point the Jews referred to Germans as non-Jewish Germans to distinguish them from Jews. And she noticed that, took note of that, and I want to do the same thing here, that this is a point that I've noticed before, that this idea of calling it's really a simple thing to do. You said they're Jews and whites are whites, Jews and whites, two separate groups. But because Jews can't stand being recognized as a distinct group in any way that would cause them to be separated from their host, they insist on these word games of actually subordinating whites to Jews by describing us as non-Jewish whites instead of just calling us whites. We don't even have the dignity of having a name for ourselves. And this is a common theme. It's not just with Jews that this happens. It's this phrase that the U.S. government uses for whites, non-Hispanic whites is what they call us in census forms and other government record keeping. And it's an insult to whites. It's a diminution, a minimization of whites as not Hispanic. Those people who are left over after you subtract out the important people, the Hispanics, or in the case of Unce's article, once you separate out the Jews, whatever whites are left behind, those people. when it comes to college, another point to make about the difference there between whites and Jews, of course, is in student organizations. In the news in the past year or two has been the white student union at Towson University. And if you know anything about colleges in the United States, every single one of them has one or more Jewish organizations, Jewish student organizations. Hillel is one of them. UNS cites Hillel statistics for how many Jews are at certain universities. Of course, because it would be anti-Semitic for anyone but Jews to count who's a Jew and who isn't a Jew, according to Jews. But whites struggle to even have one white student union. In the few places where there are preceding this white student union, they were called, there were some organizations called the Youth for Western Civilization, different chapters at a handful of universities. It created almost as much controversy, and it wasn't even explicitly white. It was just Youth for Western Civilization. Left it that open. But the white student union really caused an uproar, and I've already talked about that, and I think most of my listeners are probably familiar with that. But it's just another example of how whites are held to a completely different standard than Jews, a lesser standard than Jews, not allowed to have our own student unions. It's pathologized and it's demonized. Nationalism is another big example of the difference between whites and Jews. In fact, there's a very good example to point to. It's a famous or infamous double standard, of course, for Jews, that they support Israel. They support nationalism for Jews in the form of Israel, and at the same time argue that whatever white country they live in, and all white countries, in fact, have to have open borders, have to allow anybody that wants to move there, because it benefits them, and also because they really don't care about white people, which is the point I'm trying to make here, is that they don't see themselves as white people. They don't see themselves as having common cause with white people. They see themselves as the enemies of white people and white people as their enemies. And so treat us to a totally different standard. And one particularly egregious example of this hypocrisy, this double standard from Jews, is someone named Menachem Rosensaft, who wrote in 2011 for the Huffington Post an article titled "Israel's Jewish Essence is Non-Negotiable." And he wrote an article saying basically that in contrast to the Palestinians, who were insisting on their own statehood, Rosensaft explicitly cited the Holocaust, you know, the Jewish narrative about how awfully they've been treated by Europeans, as the justification for them to have their own country in Israel. Then 5 months later, he wrote another article for the Huffington Post titled "White Nationalism, a Scourge That Won't Go Away." Well, if Jews really considered themselves to be white, then Zionism would be, in their minds, a form of white nationalism. And it would be no different. A lot of white nationalists, well, maybe not a lot, but there's a certain phase that certain white nationalists go through where they say, hey, well, the Jews are white, and so Zionism is really just a form of white nationalism. Well, if that were really true, then Jews, even if Menachem Rosensaft doesn't think that and doesn't like white people, other Jews would have come forward and called him on this double standard. But they didn't. In this article against white nationalism, he's talking about Peter Brimelow, who I don't think even really identifies himself as a white nationalist. He's focused particularly on immigration, restricting immigration. He's created VDare.com, runs that website. But he has associated in the past with other people who could conceivably be called white nationalists or pro-white figures. What Rosensaft says is, why should the rest of us be concerned when a white nationalist racist like him appears at an event with, say, Mitt Romney, Newt Gingrich, other Republicans. He doesn't really explain that. He just leaves it hanging there. He cites the ADL saying some negative things about V-Dare and other of the people that Brimlow has associated with. He doesn't even cite Brimlow himself saying this. It is Brimlow he's quoting as saying that he favors an explicitly white nationalist political party. I guess Brimlow is more of a white nationalist than I realized. Good for him. But Rosensaft cites that as if there's something wrong with that. And where have we heard that somewhere else before? Is in Israel. It exists today. If Jews were white. But Jews aren't white. Jews are Jews, and they have their own standards for themselves and don't really see whites as equivalent. Jared Taylor was one of the people that Rosensaft condemned, or condemned by association with Peter Brimlow. So for all of Jared Taylor's open-mindedness that Jews are white in his eyes, Jews don't reciprocate, and they see Jared Taylor as just another racist, another stupid, crazy, evil white guy. He concludes this Rosensaft by saying, "We all know that there are bigots among us who espouse theories of racial, ethnic, or religious superiority, and they have a right to express their views, however noxious, on street corners or on their websites. No one, however, is obliged to invite them to be part of polite society." And that's how Jews do what they do. I mean, this guy is a bigot who espouses his theory of racial, ethnic, and religious superiority about Israel and about the Jews, about his group. But at the same time, he can say something like that and not even be thinking of himself. It's a completely unselfconscious condemnation of a description of something that describes himself. But that's how Jews argue. In this case, it's about whites, of course, and relevant to this discussion, the contrast between Jews and whites. A couple of other articles I'll link to that you can read the details of, but the headlines are basically in defense of Israel and Jews being too Jewish. One is titled, "Israel Can Never Be Too Jewish," in the foreword.com. "There can never be too much Judaism. Our Jewish identity can never be too much. It can only be too little." That's how Jews think about Jewishness, and that's what came out of the Pew poll too. They feel good about being Jews. As much as they complain about how oppressed they are, they like being Jews, and they want to be Jews, and they enjoy the benefits of that cohesiveness. The difference between Jews and whites, but let's get down to the real difference here. It's the difference between parasite and its host. And that explains the difference in attitudes between Jews and whites on both sides. The parasite is adapted toward infiltration and the extraction of resources from its host. The parasite, therefore, doesn't care for the host. And when one host is used up, it goes and finds another one. It perceives any recognition or resistance to what it's doing as a mortal threat, as it should, because if the host throws it out and it can't find another one, it'll die. Among the main efforts are of the parasite are to break down the defenses of the host. They are pathological. They pathologize whites. They're pathogenic.